I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about Indiana's forests. We'll discuss logging, legislation, and other issues that touch upon the state's wooded areas. My guests are John Seifert, State Forester with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, Dr. Leslie Bishop, Science Advisor for the Indiana Forest Alliance, and Dr. Gabriel Filippelli, IUPUI Professor of Earth Sciences. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about issues regarding Indiana's forests. We're going to talk logging. We're going to talk legislation, forest management, all of those issues. If you want to join this conversation, and I suspect there are going to be a lot of people who will want to, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm joined here in studio by my two guests, Dr. Leslie Bishop of the Indiana Forest Alliance and Dr. Gabriel Filippelli, who is from the IUPUI. He's an IUPUI professor of earth sciences. He's a veteran. I think this is Leslie's first experience with the show. It's good to have you both here.
Thank you very much for having us.
And thank you.
Certainly. To sort of set the stage for this conversation, a couple of days ago, I interviewed State Forester with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, John Seifert. And we're going to listen to that interview first. Mostly what I talked with him about was process questions, about how decisions are made regarding the state's forests. So we will start by listening to that interview. We are talking with John Seifert. He is the director of the Division of Forestry for the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. I'd like you to walk me through what the process is for making decisions about logging in Indiana's forests.
Well, actually, we prefer to think of it as management of the state forest, in that we're looking at more than just the tree, so to speak. We're looking at wildlife considerations. We're looking at biological considerations. And so I don't like people want to focus on the logging part of it. Mm-hmm. It's obviously the end result. But when our foresters and our ecologists are looking at doing some manipulation in the forest, there's a lot of considerations they look at.
And what are those considerations?
Well, looking at age, diversity issues, wildlife issues, unique features, even archaeological features that we might want to protect.
And, you know, when you talk about age issues, is age the older the tree, the better or worse?
It's both. For us, you know, when we look at our age structure, we want to have what we call a normally distributed population. So we want to have young trees, medium-aged trees, and older trees.
And when you start this this decision-making process, what is the trigger that you look at, or what are the triggers? I suspect there are several of them that say at some level we ought to intervene here.
Sure. We have a pretty intensive inventory system that we measure about a fifth of the state forest every year, and we're looking at diversity, species age, mortality. It's kind of interesting when we look at our data pre-management of any intervention versus what we're actually removing when we make a harvest. They're pretty much mimicking what we're seeing as we walk through the forest. We know that there are some species that are aging out just like you and I do. There's a period of time when they're just biologically mature and they're just going to senesce. Then there's other areas that, and other species that we'll know will grow on for another 50, 100, maybe 200 years. So we look at all of those things. And our foresters on the ground, we have these sort of big picture what the forest should look like. And then that sort of trickles down to each state forest to manage to meet those goals.
And who ultimately makes the decision? Obviously, it sounds like you got quite a few people who are out doing the information gathering here, the data collection.
Sure. We have a group of independent people that do the inventory work, and then that information is summarized every year at a state forest level as well as a system level. And then depending on where we think the species mixes are at, whether their age classes are at, where we think mortality is going to start impacting, then that gets trickled down to the individual state forest, and then that state forest makes those determinations, those foresters on the ground.
And is there a process for public input on this?
Absolutely,
because obviously, yeah.
Yes, we've always had public input. Some of it's more formalized than others. We have open houses every year where we try and present projects that we think we're going to move forward. They include not only the timber forest management side, they include recreation, they may include nature preserve issues. So it's a pretty holistic process. And then if we decide to make a management decision on an individual track, we provide a written management plan, and usually that's built on a previous management plan, because many of these stands that we call stands or 100-acre tracks have been on our system for years and years and years. So some of them may have never had any harvests in for the last 20, 30 years. Some of have had multiple harvests over our ownership period of time.
What is the biggest misperception about management of forestry?
Well, there's a lot. A good question to ask. I mean, there's the perception from many folks is that, you know, before the European settlement, that this was an old growth forest that stretched from the Atlantic to the Mississippi River. And we're preparing a pretty good analysis of that that's going to probably refute some of those issues. Native Americans have been managing this landscape for a long period of time, and then European settlement, and then obviously our intrusion in the early 1900s had a significant impact. So this man's been a part of the forest system all along.
And if people, obviously right now the trigger on all of this is the concern about Yellowwood.
Correct.
And all of that, given that there are people who are upset about that, do they have a recourse? Is there an appeals process of some sort, or, you know, is the decision one that, you know, just can't be moved?
Well, you know, if people bring us good science, I mean, you know, we try and keep the political issues out of forest management because you're dealing with a biological system. And yes, you can tweak it and some of the outcomes may not be as you perceived originally, but we've always taken, and this goes way beyond my period of time, we let the science drive it. And if people want certain areas that are non-managed areas, the state legislature was quite good at this in the early turn of the century in that they established state parks, state nature preserves, Division of Fish and Wildlife, and Division of Forestry. We all have our agendas and our goals, and if you're into an area that you don't think should be managed, as forest timber management, then that's why their nature preserves are there. That's why the state parks are there. And in reality, that a lot of other divisions don't have off-limits areas as well. And we do, too. It's just not the level that some people want it to be at right today.
So their recourse then ultimately would be to try to take it to the state legislature?
Well, you know, again, once you let the legislature get involved in a process that's driven by biology, there's unintended consequences that may not play out for years and years into the future. So you're correct. I mean, if you want to trump the science, then your recourse is to go to legislature.
What are the factors that would tell you we cannot intervene here? Are there situations in which you would say because of a rare species or something like that, this would not be a good idea?
The Division of Nature Preserves and also wildlife biologists, they spend a lot of time looking at state lands and those unique areas that we think or they think need to be protected from harvesting. They're already set aside, and we're in the process of setting a few of those aside right now. That doesn't mean down the road that they won't have to do some management, because what people really don't understand and missed is over this long period of time, we call this a disturbance ecosystem, meaning that many of the species that people might consider threatened and endangered probably were derived from a disturbance factor, fire, aggressive burning, aggressive agriculture. So there's a lot of science behind what we do.
In terms of the dispute over Yellowwood, do you see any ground for compromise or some way to bring the sides closer together on this?
I think we did quite a bit on the Yellowwood situation. I mean, we have actually compromised the science side of it, and knowing that by either allowing nature to take its course through natural selection, you're going to change that forest, whether you believe it or not. It's going to go from an oak-dominated forest to a beech maple forest, and everybody would say, well, so what? It's still trees. But it has impacts. It has impacts on food reserves. It has impacts on a lot of species of wildlife that may be dependent on that species mix. So I don't like to get into the discussion about an individual tract because we're managing at a much higher level. And if you try and micromanage a system, the unintended consequences is you're going to have less diversity. The science is just too strong to say otherwise.
What are the risks associated with not intervening?
Again, you're going to lose diversity. I mean, we know that there's differences between a north slope and a south slope and a east slope and west slope and what kind of species are there. But because we're in this what we call a mesic environment where we have lots of moisture and pretty good soils, you're going to have a slow succession change of species, and you're going to have what we call heavy mass-producing good food type species for wildlife, eventually going to species that aren't there, don't provide that kind of food source. So that's the thing that it takes lifetimes to see that. And people's perception today is, I want this today. I've lived here in my 20 years, and that's how I want it. And we say, no, we can't manage a system that takes hundreds of years to evolve that way.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, anytime.
That was my interview with John Seifert, who is the director of the Forestry Division of Indiana's Department of Natural Resources. We're talking about Indiana's forests, how they should be managed and preserved here on No Limits today. My other guests are Leslie Bishop from the Indiana Forest Alliance and Gabriel Filippelli. He is a professor of earth sciences at IUPUI. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. I talked with John Seifert primarily about process questions there. There's an awful lot to unpack, but from what I can tell, just in the conversation, the themes, we've got to talk about the science, we've got to talk about, what the public policy implications are, legislation, and all of that. And we're going to be coming up on a break here in a couple of minutes, so I'm going to give each of you a little bit of time to just share first your overall impressions, and then we'll dive into the components. Leslie, I'll start with you first.
Sure, thank you. I think the question that I would ask Mr. Seifert, if he were sitting here, is how can we develop the diversity of age classes, including old growth in the future, by also achieving all of his goals? I think that the age class that is underrepresented, besides early successional stages, are the age class between the ages of 20 and 90, after 100 years old. So old growth is very rare in Indiana. It supports a rich biological diversity that is becoming diminished. Our state forests are an incredible opportunity to provide that type of habitat. And I really don't see by not allowing this type of age class, I don't see how that is contradictory to management plans.
Gabriel.
Well, I'd say that forest ecosystems, like all ecosystems, are extremely complicated and under a whole range of pressures. Those include those that that are management related, so how we manage forests. But there's also external pressures which aren't really accounted for in most management schemes. For example, the overriding roles that climate change and nutrient changes on landscapes will play in forests. And that's exactly the science that we need and the science that we hope to provide with our Environmental Resilience Institute down at Indiana University of Bloomington, a new multi-campus institute to focus on these issues.
That's a good starting point for our conversation. We're talking about logging forests and forest management today on No Limits. My guests are Gabriel Filippelli of IUPUI and Leslie Bishop of the Indiana Forest Alliance. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about Indiana's forest today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Leslie Bishop. She is from the Indiana Forest Alliance. And Gabriel Filippelli. He is a professor of earth sciences at IUPUI. Before we went to the break, I talked, did a pre-recorded interview with John Seifert, who is the director of the Forestry Division of the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. I gave Leslie and Gabriel an incredibly brief time to share their thoughts on that interview. I'd like to give you a little more time here to, you know, to give a more rounded appraisal of how the process works or doesn't work as he explains it. I gave Leslie the first word last time, so I'm going to give it to Gabriel and let her have the last word this time.
Well, thank you, John. I think I would focus on the issue that he brought up a number of times, which is the science. And this is where it gets really complicated, frankly. There is no cookbook of science to manage ecosystems in a way that make them infinitely resilient, largely because each ecosystem has its own characteristics. And he acknowledged that to some extent. But also because if you don't put the right ingredients into that model for the perfect ecosystem, you come up failing. And here's one of the issues that I have with some of these land use models is that a forest, as any ecosystem is, functions best when it's continuous within the range of its capacity for mobility of species. What that does is it allows species that live in the forest to move back and forth stably and safely, and it provides a certain degree of resilience to the ecosystem as a whole. When we say ecosystem, we're talking about literally thousands of unique species from bacteria to trees that coexist in a certain balance. When you break that into pieces, certainly as a big impediment to wildlife transitioning, it also makes the little pieces very susceptible to disease.
Mm-hmm. Leslie.
That's a great point. I think that with any ecosystem, we cannot predict the future. We don't even have the knowledge base yet. There's so many gaps in our knowledge and in our understanding of what's going to be coming down the pike. And I think the issue of invasive species, in pests and pathogens in forests or in any of our ecosystems is a big unknown. And how we build our forest to be a resilient system is critical at this time, because we are starting to see ramifications of climate change already in forests. And these changes can take place it's going to happen over a long period of time, way beyond our lifetimes. But we need to be concerned now about how we are protecting these systems for the future.
If you are just joining us, We are talking about Indiana's forests and the issues, controversies surrounding their management. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Linda has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Linda, you're on the air.
Yes, I had a couple of questions. My first one is, why wasn't Mr. Seifert in person in your studio to actually debate and discuss these issues rather than on tape where he really can't be, he can only be indirectly responded to? Well, that was my first question.
Okay.
And if it was a scheduling issue, I'm certain you would have rescheduled to enable him to show up since he is a big actor in this discussion.
Well, let me put it this way. Let me answer your first question. Linda, let me answer your first question first so that people don't get lost in this. As we do with every program, when we set a date that seems to be convenient to the most parties, we issue invitations far and wide and try to get as many different sides of the question in here in studio or at least on the phone. We issued the invitation to Mr. Seifert. He can explain his reasons himself for not. We decided to do the interview ahead of time because we thought his input was important to the discussion. But he was invited to appear here live in the studio.
Okay, so I'm sure he was invited, and my point is that he's too really insecure in his stand on these issues to show up and debate in person, and that's been his practice throughout his management of the state forests. So that was my first point, is that I think if he really believed in what he had to say and was willing to defend it in person, he would be in a lot stronger position than he is. And then my second point is a pretty small one, but it follows up on what Leslie Bishop was just saying, in that he cites the nature preserves as examples of unmanaged areas in the state. But that, again, is disingenuous because the nature preserves, the largest of them are maybe 100 acres, maybe a little bit more. They're scattered around. They're not the large contiguous block of forest that the backcountry represented. So, again, a kind of a disingenuous answer to a really straightforward question. And I guess that's my piece. Thank you for listening.
Thanks very much for the call, Linda. We appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So, Leslie, since she referenced you, I'll give you the first chance to respond to her points.
I appreciate that Linda brought up the idea of our nature preserves. These are really important areas in our state kind of portfolio of lands in that they are set aside from logging, but they're scattered across the state. They don't all represent the deciduous forests that we have in the southern part of the state, but they do represent special areas. They're very small. And the issue of biological diversity as well as resilience in the time of change requires tracts of forest that are allowed to progress through their natural aging processes in order that, for one thing, so that we can, so scientists can actually study those natural processes, but also so that we have areas that we can actually compare to what's happening in the adjacent forest management styles. So we can actually say, okay, this is what's happening in a control site, and this is the result of a single tree selection. We need very much to have these areas set aside in the state forests so that we have comparisons.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about Indiana's forests today on No Limits. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Kathy. If you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Kathy writes, when John Seifert says they have opportunity for public input, he is grossly misrepresenting the situation. When was the last time the public was invited to an open, balanced conversation on logging the backcountry for the timber industry? I know for a fact hundreds of Hoosiers have called the governor's office protesting the logging of Yellowwood. How many calls did he get in support of the logging? DNR, DOF does not allow input from the public. Gabriel, you're smiling, so I'm going to go with you on that one.
It's critical with any government process to be open and transparent and accountable. It's not always the loudest voice that's the most correct, but in cases like this, I would say that that most of the science would support the fact that forests as natural ecosystems are critical to our planet. And to treat forests like farm fields, which is exactly what this management scheme is doing, threatens to turn the forest ecosystem largely into what farm fields look like now, one of the least diverse ecosystems on the planet.
I want to say before we move on, and I know we're getting calls and I've got several more emails here, to pick up on at least one of the points I thought I heard in the interview with John Seifert. Admittedly, he said first, obviously, that the science dictates what they do. But the second part of that ultimately was, and this sort of answers Linda's question, although I'm leery of answering on behalf of other people, but I'm trying to extrapolate at least what I heard from him. It is that he doesn't set policy, that the legislature did that back in the early part of this century by changing some of the laws and codes, and that it's simply his job to implement what state government. Now, at the end of that, admittedly, at the end of the interview, he said, might not be a wise idea to invite the legislature back into this debate. Because that could have implications as well. But at least that seemed to be the overall thrust of what I was hearing, which takes us into the other part of this question, is that there is legislation before the Indiana General Assembly right now that attempts to deal at some level with these questions. Leslie, I know your organization is behind that. Do you want to summarize what Senate Bill 275 is about?
I'll be happy to. Senate Bill 275 would require DNR to set aside 30% of each state forest. We have 13 state forests. Set aside 30% of each forest from logging. And that would mean that these areas would still be available for recreation, for scientific study, but not available for logging. And this really is not an unreasonable request, given that prior to 2005, DNR had set aside 40% of the state forest from logging. Currently, if we just add up the nature preserves and state parks, couple small areas in the hardwood ecosystem experiment controls and the areas around bat hibernacula, which are all areas that are free from logging, that's less than 3%. So I think that there are many, many Hoosiers are seeing that there's not a balance there. And this bill is really a way to require DNR to set aside these areas.
And I checked on it this morning, and I realize sometimes the state government website can be a little slow in updating, but it has been assigned to committee, but has it received a hearing yet?
It has not. We have not heard yet if it's received a hearing. We're hoping, and I think there's plenty of support. There's a bipartisan support, and we're, I'm not sure what the update is today.
We are talking about Indiana's forests and forest management, forest preservation, particularly regarding the issue of logging here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Rock has done and reach out to us via Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Rock has several questions and comments. Rock, with your permission, I'm going to take just the first one because I think it gets to the heart of this. If we have time and we get other listeners' questions satisfied, I'll come back and deal with the others. Rock writes, I appreciate Dr. Bishop's advocacy for our forests. I met her at the Yellowwood protest rally the day of the timber sale. After the sale, I asked Jack Seifert why such sudden exponential increase in commercial logging is occurring since he was appointed director of the Division of Forestry. He cut me off in mid-sentence, and his response was simply, the data changed. I would appreciate Dr. Bishop's reply to Jack Seifert's answer, especially in light of the 239 and rising Indiana scientists opposed to Mr. Seifert's data or rationale. Okay, I'm going to start with Leslie on that one, but I also want to hear Gabriel's thoughts.
Okay. I'm not sure that the data changed, and if I'm not sure what data Mr. Seifert's talking about, but I suppose, and what I understand that changed is the need for production of the forest, that the need to harvest for economic purposes. So to me, maybe it's the economic data that changed, and that may be what he is referring to. So I'm not really sure what he meant by that, that the data changed. Science data doesn't change. It evolves. It changes in terms of new findings, but it builds on previous data. So I'm not sure what he meant.
Gabriel.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not the science part of it that's changing. I'm sure it's the attitude in economics. However, what is changing is something I referred to earlier, and that's climate. You know, climate is that's the overriding pressure behind all of this. And 2017, announced this morning, was once again among the very hottest years we've ever had, you know, the outside weather notwithstanding. So it's this large, huge external pressure on ecosystems that I think we are undervaluing. And when you have a management timescale that's looking at the short term and climate change timescale, which is occurring on a longer term, that mismatch of timescales could very well lead to ecological disaster for many of the forests.
In other parts of my life, and I'm not going to bore the audience or you guys with this, I've had to deal with questions of responsible management of forests in connection with some other parts of my life. And I have heard in those times persuasive arguments for selective logging, where they say there are times actually for the health of the forest it is good for you to do that. Leslie, you're nodding your head. What are those circumstances? Are those circumstances valid where there are times when actually you should take some timber out?
Yes. A lot of the management of our forest is based on, or the science behind it, is based on the fact that oak hickory is not replacing itself in our forest. Our forests are maturing. A lot of our forest in southern Indiana are approaching about 100 years old. And so since the concern of DNR is on production, in order to maintain oak hickory forest, then thinning is needed for them to open up areas for oak hickory to rejuvenate. So that's probably the biggest issue. Biological diversity is important in terms of both structural and species compositional diversity. So with openings in the forest, you get very different groups of organisms that move in. One of those being invasives, which we can get to after the next break.
We are talking about Indiana's forests and how we should care for them today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Leslie Bishop. She is with the Indiana Forest Alliance, and Gabriel Filippelli. He is a professor of earth sciences at IUPUI. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Indiana's forests and the challenges of caring for them, particularly surrounding issues involving logging and in the state forests. My guests are Gabriel Filippelli, he is professor of earth sciences at IUPUI, and Leslie Bishop of the Indiana Forest Alliance. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Jeff has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Well, I was very involved in the commenting on the Yellowwood backcountry area logging and spoke to a number of scientists also who commented. And I noted Mr. Seifert saying that a lot of their decision-making, that they do invite the public to get involved in it, and that when particularly their science, good science, they scientists bringing to the table, that they take that into account, and their decisions are informed by that. But I know that in this case, for example, a number of scientists commented on those plans, asked them not to move forward with logging those tracks, and their comments were rebuffed without acknowledgement. For example, John Whitaker, Dr. John Whitaker, was the advisor for mammals policy for the DNR for 25 years. He mapped the ranges of rare forest shrews in Indiana, and he found them in the very tract that they were proposing to log there at Yellowwood. And he commented to them and urged them not to move forward with this logging because it was going to harm the shrew habitat there. The top bat mitigation firm did bat netting in that forest and found that the health of the maternity roosts of Indiana bats was so good that it urged in a report to the state that they not remove any of the snags, which are a big target of this logging. They just leave the forest intact. One of the top botanists in the entire United States actually studied that tract and said that the quality of the plant community was unparalleled in for forests in southern Indiana. And the president of the Indiana Academy of Sciences also did a similar assessment and said the diversity there, the natural diversity, was of paramount importance to conserve intact. All of these comments they received, they none of them were acknowledged. And so I'm concerned when I hear Mr. Seifert talking about how they're making these decisions based on the best science. Well, what they're doing is ignoring science from scientists that they don't agree with. And that's just a fact. And what they did with the Yellowwood logging, it demonstrates that.
Thanks very much for the call. I'm going to give Gabriel the first chance to respond to that. Thank you very much for the call, Jeff.
Thank you.
Yeah, in fact, this was generally the sentiment from the group of scientists from the Environmental Resilience Institute, which comprised quite a few faculty from the IU system, that stated that the science is firmly behind the preservation of these systems. And I would also kind of broaden this conversation somewhat to this issue that what is the value of a species? The caller identified a couple organisms that would no longer be there. What is the value to species? Well, we don't really know that, but I will tell you that each of the individual pieces of an ecosystem are all critical. That's why they're there. And they actually provide a value for all. Species provide a value for all versus the commodity, the tree, which provides a value for a corporation.
I'm going to try to keep moving us through because we are getting lots of questions here. This one is an email from a listener named Elizabeth. And again, if you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Elizabeth writes, Mr. Seifert and his Department of Forestry are always talking about their decision-making process being based on science. There are many, many pedigreed scientists here in Indiana and throughout the country who are in strong disagreement with the DNR's forest management approach. What do we do when our interpretations of science disagree? Seems to me the DNR gives other scientists absolutely no opportunity for participation in the process. DNR, DOF are unilaterally making decisions that will inform the health of the forest for hundreds of years to come. What if they are wrong? Is the implementation of the precautionary process applicable in at least part of the state forest system? I'm not laughing at your question, Elizabeth. I am laughing at the fact that I do not seem to be able to talk today, and that is an impediment in radio. Leslie, I'm going to give you the first crack at that one.
Oh, there are many things I could say to that one, but I did want to bring up one point that her question brings up for me, and that is that management schemes may be based on some scientific studies, but they can't predict what new studies are going to show. And a good example of that is with the emerald ash borer, which is taking down all the ash trees throughout the Midwest. And just recently, there's been several studies that have shown that ash trees are resilient, that there are individuals that are resilient. They may be attacked by the beetles, but they are resilient in that they persist and they can reproduce. And so if we have a management scheme such as Indiana's forestry does, if we have a management scheme that goes in to remove the dead and dying trees or diseased trees when they see that they're infested, then we are losing an incredible opportunity to have trees that may be resilient in the long run. So I think science, you know, does inform us, but it also changes. We learn new things, and which is why we need diverse age structures in the forest. And it's not just maintaining an age structure, but allowing these set-asides. What they do is allow the forest to progress in a natural way towards its late successional stage, which is old-growth forest. And that's the opportunity we have right now. And we're losing it by logging.
We're talking about Indiana's forests here on No Limits. John, you're on the air.
Hi. John, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Long-time listener, first-time caller. I just wanted to call in as a tree farm owner. My family has owned a farm in Johnson County, the county south of Marion County, since the 1820s. I'm the present generation who is caretaking of that part of God's creation. And we, in 1975, planted a 15-acre black walnut plantation. Last year with the DNR, I set aside another 45 acres of untillable forest land to be left alone, but which can still be timber farm. And I bring this up to say that as a tree farmer, I think that one factor in the equation of whether to log all or set aside 30% of our state lands is that there's a number of private landowners who have timber for sale and who are growing it and who are managing it. So I think we can set aside 30% of the forests without hurting the timber industry whatsoever. That's my comment. I'll listen off air.
Thanks very much for the call and for the question comment, John. Thanks. Leslie.
Oh, thank you for calling that in, because it's really important that we all know that there's about 85% of Indiana forests are privately owned, and only 3% is controlled by the state. So there's and the timber industry is not going to be hurt by this 30% set aside in that little tiny 3%. But what that little tiny 30% does for us is allow us to have a forest that is representative of all of the successional stages.
I've gotten an email from a listener named Charles. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Charles writes, "Hi, John. Gabriel states that management of state forests threatens to turn forests into farm fields. This is completely false. Farm fields have one plant species growing in monoculture, examples of corn or soy. A managed forest will have a dominant canopy of oak, hickory, tulip, poplar, cherry, maple, and many other hardwood species, and a whole host of understory species. A managed forest is what humans have evolved with on this planet." Leslie states that within an ecosystem, we can't predict the future. This is totally wrong. With Indiana forest ecosystems, we can totally predict what species will dominate the canopy in the future because they are present as seedlings and saplings ready to rise up after overstory mortality. If there is no management, shade-tolerant species will become dominant in the overstory, and the oak hickory ecosystem, so important to many animals, including us, will be lost. DNR understandably doesn't want to lose this part, important part of our heritage. Gabriel, you were mentioned first. Since both of you were called into question here, I'm going to give each of you a chance to respond. I'll start with Gabriel since you were the first one, but then Leslie, I'll give you a chance too.
Yeah, and I do appreciate that input. I'll say that once you put the manage in front of something, you effectively are no longer treating it as a vibrant, self-repairing, resilient ecosystem. So this idea that it is so far-fetched to think of managed forests being similar to agricultural fields is actually pretty valid. I mean, these are managed systems. So you, meaning a person, based on supposedly science, are deciding what stays and what goes. That's what management is. And if the science isn't robust or isn't heard from adequately, then you haven't managed it correctly.
Leslie.
And the other part to that is that by having set-asides, that does not mean that there isn't still the possibility for managing for oak hickory forests in the remaining of the forests. So there's plenty of opportunity within that scheme to have both goals.
We've gotten sort of a comment from a listener via Facebook, and you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. This is from Corey. She writes, "My dream would be that advocates could offer a visual exploration of the history and impact of logging and deforestation in the state of Indiana. I think because it's a relatively slow process, people do not have a sense of and can't picture or visualize what we have lost and what is at risk of disappearing. Once old growth and virgin woods are gone, they are not replaceable. If you look at an image of Indiana on Google Earth, you can see a few beautiful patches of green that represent Morgan, Monroe, Brown County, and Hoosier National Forest. This state was once almost completely covered with virgin woods. The contrast between our current state and historic state is harsh. I do not mean to suggest that we could or should ever return to a fully tree-covered state, but knowing what we have already lost gives a sense of what stands to be lost with current practices. Thank you." Leslie, do you have any response, I presume, other than amen?
I think that she brings up a really important aspect of all of this, and that is the aesthetics and just our the basic need that we have, that we can benefit from being in nature and being in a forest that is in a forest that is not being managed, where you can have large trees and space to really experience what a forest can be, is something that I wish everyone could experience, and I really hope that our grandchildren can experience.
We are talking about Indiana's forests here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Sarah has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Sarah, you are on the air.
Yes, a tree farmer in southern Indiana offered $150,000 for the trees not to be cut, with the stipulation they wouldn't be cut for 100 years. This is the price that the DNR said the trees were worth, and they ended up selling them for $108,000 below cost. What this did also is put local tree farmers, because these trees are sold below what the normal tree farmer would get, and most of the trees would end up being shipped out of the country also, is what I've been told. So besides the fact that they were offered money, economic value, they also are destroying the competition of the local tree farmer. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Gabriel.
Yeah, I certainly heard that that report as well, and I think we can't forget that as many people may be listening to this don't understand how important forestry and logging is actually for Indiana agricultural economy. It's a huge proportion of that. And it's going on all over the place, largely in what several of the callers have mentioned, their own tree farms, where it's perfectly, you know, they perfectly manage it. In fact, privately owned land has far less forest loss than does publicly owned land, based on comparison throughout the 1900s. So, yes to the speaker and or to the call-in, and I would say that, you know, I think it's just, again, critical to, if you have the potential to allow something to mature properly, and it's not the an absolute critical resource that you have to log that particular one at that particular time, just let it be.
Gotten an email from a listener named Marcia, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Marcia writes, "Dear John, last summer I was sitting in the parking lot of McDonald's at the corner of Keystone Avenue and Ruth Drive eating lunch. While I was sitting there, three or four semi-flatbed trucks, as well as one or two tractor trailers with the name Homer Industries on the cab, went by heading north on Keystone. The flatbeds were filled with huge old-growth tree trunks. I can't emphasize strongly enough the number of tree trunks on these three or four flatbeds, as well as how large the trees were. My questions are, who is Homer or Home Industries? Where would these trees have come from, and where would they be going? As always, thank you for the wide-ranging subjects you discuss on your program." Leslie, any ideas?
I sure couldn't predict where they came from. But I do want to respond to one thing, and that is, these are not old-growth forests. But what we're hoping, and by setting aside, these are forests that are secondary forests that are now 100 years old. And yes, they are big trees. At 100 years old, you get some very big trees. The set-aside allows them to progress to old growth. So we aren't there yet, but the only way to get there is to stop logging certain areas.
And we mentioned earlier that one of the avenues now for people to make their voices heard is through Senate Bill 275. If people do want to register where they stand on this issue, how should they go about doing that, Leslie?
The first thing they need to do is contact their legislator, their local legislator immediately, and ask their legislator to support the bill. They can look on the Indiana government website for committee members of the Natural Resource Committee. Contact the committee members and tell them that it's important to hear this bill. But mainly through legislators, it's really important that they know where people stand.
I'd like to thank both of you for what has been a lively conversation, Leslie Bishop and Gabriel Filippelli. For talking about Indiana's forests, also would like to thank John Seifert of Indiana DNR for recording an interview earlier. And to our listeners, we're going to be back on Tuesday, but not from here. We're going to be broadcasting live from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Hope you will join us. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.